It is Friday, August the 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Cairo attacked the work of the Islamic State or Muslim Brotherhood.
I see this attack and in general the violence in Egypt as being perpetrated by the Islamic State, not by the Muslim Brotherhood.
Also ahead, alleged sexual assaults in the CAR, plus the health of a former U.S. president. Hello everyone, I'm Steve Norman. An Islamic State affiliated group has claimed responsibility for a large car bomb attack outside a state security building in Cairo. It happened Thursday, wounding dozens in the country's latest militant attack. Eyewitnesses are saying that the bombers parked an explosives-laden car outside the government facility before escaping into another vehicle. VOA's Jeffrey Young asked RAND Corporation Middle East analyst Jeffrey Martini about the lack of fatalities in this particular incident, which is unusual when it comes to Islamic State attacks.
It is unusual. It's unusual in terms of the timing, as you mentioned, that it was at a time when the building would certainly not be occupied. It was also unusual in that it was not a suicide attack, but the perpetrator escaped. And so to me, that suggests that really the Islamic State here was going for the symbolism that they could hit a government installation in Cairo, and they weren't as concerned with the amount of damage they could do in terms of casualties.
Would you characterize this bombing in any way as any connection or a response to Egyptian President Fatah al-Sisi's campaign to round up and jail the Muslim Brotherhood? I mean, after all, they're all Islamists. Is there any connection at all?
I don't see a strong connection there. Now, to be fair to the Sisi regime, which does allege a connection between the Muslim Brotherhood and the Islamic State, there are now elements of the Muslim Brotherhood who are on the record as adopting violence. But I see this attack and in general the violence in Egypt as being perpetrated by the Islamic State, not by the Muslim Brotherhood. And I think the regime overplays the intersection between those two groups, although we do not have great visibility into how many members of the Muslim Brotherhood who are disaffected may have, you know, left the Brotherhood to join the Islamic State.
This bombing also came just days after President al-Sisi signed a new anti-terrorism law, which not only broadens police powers and restricts human rights, but also affects the press with fines for those who don't hew to the official government line regarding terrorism and those who perpetrate it. Any connection with this bombing and the new terrorism law, or is this purely coincidental?
Well, in terms of the way the Islamic State is framing this in their statement, they were saying that the timing of the bombing was driven by their desire to have revenge for the hanging, that is, the Sisi regime prosecuted and executed by hanging several individuals from the Sinai who were accused of carrying out earlier attacks on behalf of the Islamic State. So that would suggest it's more coincidental, the idea that this would be linked to the anti-terrorism legislation, although certainly there's some rich symbolism there as well.
That is Jeffrey Martini, a Middle East analyst at the RAND Corporation, speaking with VOA's Jeffrey Young. U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter said Thursday Turkey needs to do more to help fight the Islamic State and to control its borders. He said Turkey has agreed in principle to join the U.S.-led airstrikes against the militants, sometimes called ISIL.
That's only one part of what we need Turkey to do and what Turkey has indicated some willingness to do. We need them also as a neighbor to this conflict zone, as a longtime NATO ally and a responsible member of the anti-ISIL coalition, to control the border, the long border that they have with both Syria and Iraq, more than it has been controlled over the last year. It is a border over which logistics for ISIL and fighters cross. And so we're looking for them to do more in that regard as well, and are in active discussions with them about that second part, which is doing more along the border. So we need Turkey to do more. We're in active discussions, including the president himself. They've indicated considerable willingness to do that. We're working through the practicalities of that, and it's extremely important for the campaign against ISIL.
Turkey agreed last month to allow U.S. jets attacking Islamic State to use Incirlik Air Base, but was focused its increased military participation in the region on its long-running fight against the Kurdish guerrillas in the area. U.S. intelligence says even after a year of the U.S. bombing campaign and some success on the ground by Iraqi forces, Islamic State is no weaker today than it was last September. Secretary Carty refused Thursday to characterize the fight against the Islamic State militants as a stalemate. More allegations of sex abuse by UN peacekeepers in the Central African Republic have been revealed. Three young women, including a minor, say that they were assaulted by peacekeepers in Bambari, a city where troops are stationed. The UN Secretary General's office says families of the young women made what it called disturbing allegations on August the 12th, and a statement from the peacekeeping mission says UN headquarters was notified immediately. At the same time of the alleged incident, the only UN troops in Bambari were those from the Democratic Republic of Congo. Among those criticizing the way the U.S. has handled the ongoing sex abuse allegations is Paula Donovan. She is co-director of the group AIDS-Free World, which launched the Code Blue campaign. Its goal is to end immunity for sexual exploitation and abuse by UN peacekeepers. Donovan spoke to VOA's Jody Kapua about the latest charges.
I think it's just horrendous that these allegations continue to flow in from this one country where the media has trained its attention, and there's something desperately wrong with the way that peacekeeping is being managed from headquarters when we see this tremendous cavalcade of allegations of rape by peacekeepers.
You call this an ongoing crisis that is clearly out of control. Why?
Well, because no part of the system is working. The Department of Peacekeeping Operations isn't controlling the senior managers who are sent out to the field to run these operations. The force commanders aren't controlling their troops. The special representatives aren't informing headquarters, or if they are, headquarters is not informing the public or the governments involved. There's just mismanagement from top to bottom, and the UN is taking the role of the helpless bystander in all of this rather than taking responsibility for the fact that they're managing a worldwide effort that costs billions of dollars every year in a way that's just not working for the civilian populations that peacekeeping is designed to protect.
Didn't UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon make a personnel change a few months ago to deal with this issue?
He made one administrative decision to fire the special representative in the Central African Republic. He announced that on the day that another allegation of rape was received by the Central African Republic, and didn't speak about the fact that this firing was provoked by one particular rape case, but since he had decided to fire this one particular special representative, yet another rape case had come in with three people who came forward to the MINUSCA, the peacekeeping mission, to say that their family members had been raped. Two women and one minor girl came forward on August 12th to say that they had also been raped by UN peacekeepers, and this was not mentioned at all by the Secretary General during his special session with the Security Council the following day.
Now, let me ask you about the Code Blue campaign. Of course, we've spoken about this before. How long has it been going on now, and what is your ultimate goal?
We launched the campaign in May of this year after doing about a year and a half of research and trying to figure out just exactly where the problems were and what the root of the problem is, and we feel as though we honed in on the source of these problems, and that's number one, that the member states are unaware of how bad the situation is at the senior leadership level of the United Nations, and that needs to be investigated by a truly external, entirely independent group that is commissioned by member states, not by the Secretary General himself, to look into peacekeeping. And a really important source of the problem is the immunity that UN peacekeeping personnel who are hired by the United Nations itself enjoy. The Secretary General says that he has a zero tolerance for sexual exploitation and abuse policy, and that therefore immunity doesn't weigh in when one of his personnel is accused of one of these crimes or what they call misconduct. But in fact, immunity is what blocks the normal justice process and prevents the UN from immediately turning over an allegation to the appropriate authorities so that a thorough, justified, impartial investigation can take place right away without delay.
Paula Donovan is co-director of the group AIDS-Free World. She was speaking from Boston with VOA's Joe DiCapua. Still ahead on VOA's International Edition, the latest on the health of former U.S. President Jimmy Carter. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Former U.S. President Jimmy Carter says tests have revealed that he has cancer of the liver and that it has spread from his liver to his brain. The 90-year-old Mr. Carter spoke Thursday at the humanitarian organization he and his wife Rosalind founded, the Carter Center in Atlanta.
They are very small spots, about 2 millimeters, if you can envision what a millimeter is. And then I understand I'll have 4 treatments scheduled at 3-week intervals.
President Carter also spoke about how he handled the news of the cancer.
But I was surprisingly at ease. You know, I've had a wonderful life. I've had thousands of friends, and I've had an exciting and adventurous and gratifying existence. So I was surprisingly at ease, much more so than my wife was.
President Carter also said he's ready for anything and looking forward to a new adventure. For some perspective on President Carter's announcement and his legacy, my colleague Sarah Williams spoke with VOA's Ken Farabaugh, who has interviewed the former president several times and has done a number of reports of Mr. Carter after his time as U.S. president.
He did say he's going to cut back on a lot of his schedule and activities related with the Carter Center, but he also indicated that he hopes to continue teaching Sunday school at his church in Plains, something he has done every weekend that he is home for most of his post-presidency. And so there are some things about his schedule, his routine, and his life that he hopes will remain as usual. But then, you know, another very dramatic another part of that will be that he's going to cut down a lot of his schedule related to work with the Carter Center. And that also includes uncertainty about whether or not he'll participate in the Habitat for Humanity Build project later this year in Nepal, which he was scheduled to do the first week of November.
Kane, you've interviewed President Carter many times, and today you asked him about, you know, what was the hardest thing about this situation. How did he respond to that?
Many people might know, if you've read about President Carter or listened to him talk, he has a very regimented, busy schedule that he keeps every day. You know, many times he'd wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning and exercise, and then he might write part of a book, and then he would participate maybe in a breakfast or a private prayer session, and then begin the day of activities, which, you know, usually included a lot of work related to the Carter Center. And so this is someone who, even at 90 years old, is extremely busy, extremely active. And so one can imagine that stepping back from a lot of that to deal with cancer would be a dramatic change for him, particularly because he's done it for so long. So I was wondering if that might be one of the hardest challenges he might face. And while he says it will be a challenge, he wants to make sure that the treatment of this cancer takes priority for him.
And another thing that struck me, it was how upbeat he seemed. He didn't seem, you know, sad. I think he said this has been harder on his wife of so many years than it has been on himself.
Yeah, that's true. And even though he was upbeat, he kept a very positive outlook. Also, too, he was a little bit more subdued than usual. I've interviewed him many times, and in those interviews, you know, he's usually upbeat. This seemed to be a little bit more subdued than usual, but given the news and given the impact on his family and the Carter Center and him revealing a lot of this for the first time publicly, you can imagine his state of mind. But he is remarkably, again, at ease with that decision, and he said that he wants to make sure that he makes room and opportunity for this treatment to take hold and help him extend his life. And he did say that he's going to do whatever doctors recommend.
That is VOA's Kane Farabaugh speaking with my colleague Sarah Williams. We turn now to G. Abby Lee for what's being said on social media about President Carter's announcement about his liver cancer and that it has now been detected in his brain. Hi, G.
Hi, Steve. People are tweeting about him a lot Thursday. His name, Jimmy Carter, was a number two trending topic on Twitter earlier, both in the United States and worldwide. The Topsy Analytics website shows hashtag Jimmy Carter was used in more than 7,000 tweets in the last 24 hours.
So, G, what's the handle you can follow to get updated information on President Carter?
Great question. There are two accounts, actually. One is a Carter Center at Carter Center on Twitter, which has more than 28,000 followers. The other is a Jimmy Carter Library. It's on Twitter at Carter Library and has more than 13,000 followers. What's really interesting, Steve, is that the number of followers for that handle jumped by 1,000 during the last 10 hours.
I see. And G, who else tweeted about this particular announcement about President Carter's health?
Well, not surprisingly, President Carter is getting a lot of support from high-profile Twitter users. President George H.W. Bush tweeted, "Him and his wife are wishing him the very best as he fights a good fight." President Obama also tweeted, "Mr. Carter is as good a man as they come, and that they're all pulling for him." Steve?
And many thanks to you, G. That is International Edition's G. Abby Lee, always right there with the latest from social media. A reminder, you can follow International Edition on Twitter if you'd like. We're at VOA_IE. Moving along, capping their history-making week, the first female soldiers to complete the U.S. Army's rigorous Rangers School are graduating. They'll do that later today. International Edition's David Byrd joins us now for more on the story.
Carla, first of all, these two young women, Captain Kristen Greist and First Lieutenant Shay Haver, are the only two women to have made it through this program, but they are not the only two women to have started. How does their graduation compare with the male candidates as far as how many people started and how many finished?
There were 19 women that were in the course. And of those 19 women, they've all dropped except for the two that are graduating on Friday. And there is one that is still completing the course. She's not quit. She's been recycled in, and she's still trying to get that Ranger tab. It's hard to compare the men versus the women because it's kind of like comparing apples to oranges in the case that the women don't have the opportunity that some of the men, not all, but some of the men have to do certain skills trainings. So some of the men kind of have a little bit of an up because they've had more training geared towards these obstacle courses and such. But if you just want to get a general comparison of the Ranger class, there are about 40% that will pass eventually. And so of this, yes, the women are much lower. But like I said, they're just getting started. And at this point, they don't have the same training, so it's hard to compare.
Now, just to give our audience a little bit of background, Army Ranger training is the elite combat training that is available in the United States Army. It involves mountaineering. It involves, you know, water combat, going without food, going without sleep, all kinds of rigorous training. And these women were able to come through that.
That's correct. And as one of the guys who's graduating on Friday told me, he goes, basically, you're more tired and hungry than you've ever been in your life, and you're just ready to be done. It's so difficult that one in four drop out after the first physical fitness test that you do. That involves an 8-kilometer run. It involves chin-ups. It involves sit-ups. It involves all times. And once you get done with that, if you move on, people continue to drop out like flies. If you want to know who makes it all the way through without having to go back and redo anything, that's only 25%. So this is not an easy course. And even though more and more will graduate, it takes them multiple times. And you're looking at the best of the best not even finishing it. So you can imagine how hard it is.
Will Captain Greist and Lieutenant Haver be allowed to join the Ranger Regiment at Fort Benning? I understand there's some roles that they won't be able to do.
Not at this point, because the Army is doing this as an experiment basically to see if women can handle it. I know that the decision is going to come down, and Ashton Carter was saying that he was going to make a decision soon on whether women can serve in combat, and that would be really great for Kristen Greist because she is really wanting to go into the special ops, and she can only do that if the rules of the Army change.
That is VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb at Fort Benning, Georgia. The official graduation ceremonies that include Captain Kristen Greist and First Lieutenant Shay Haver are Friday.
And many thanks to you, Dave Bird of International Edition, and of course you, Carla Babb, over at the Pentagon. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Egypt has completed the expansion of the Suez Canal, a massive 3-year project finished in just one. Egyptians themselves helped finance the canal, buying nearly $5 billion worth of bonds for the $8.5 billion project. Cairo resident Ali Assad. He says no one in Egypt or outside believed that it could be achieved in such a period. He says the best part of it was financed by the Egyptian people. At ETX Capital, analyst David Papier says the larger canal could carry additional benefits.
They are looking to increase infrastructure, housing, healthcare. You know, the opening of this new canal could bring these things to Egypt, and it also could increase, you know, exports from other nations and other multinational companies.
The number of ships passing through the canal will nearly double to 97 a day, and the annual earnings for Egypt are expected to more than double to over $13 billion a year. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. You know, open-air classical musical festivals have become a staple of American life in the summer, but 75 years ago when the Boston Symphony first performed on a former estate called Tanglewood, it was a completely new idea. And now Jeff London takes us to Tanglewood.
When Serge Koussevitzky, the Russian-born conductor of the Boston Symphony Orchestra, opened Tanglewood in 1937, he chose an all-Beethoven program, including the Pastorale Symphony. And when conductor Christoph von Dohnányi opened the 75th anniversary season in early July, he recreated it. Beethoven's musical tribute to nature, complete with bird calls, seems a perfect companion to the charms of Tanglewood. When you walk through the trees and open fields of the campus, you come across music everywhere. French horn players rehearsing Strauss in a cabin in the woods. The string quartet playing contemporary music on a concert hall stage. Two trumpets rehearsing Beethoven in a barn.
And It's a place where music and nature come together in the most wonderfully natural way.
Conductor John Williams has composed many of the most famous movie scores. He's been coming to Tanglewood every summer since 1980, when he was named music director of the Boston Pops.
We learn something about ourselves as musicians and as listeners out here every day when we're here among the trees and the beautiful weather and so on.
Boston Symphony Managing Director Mark Volpe oversees the 1,000 employees and volunteers at Tanglewood from a Victorian house on the property.
Every city has a concert hall. What makes the Boston Symphony absolutely unique in the world of orchestras is Tanglewood. Tanglewood really is the granddaddy of this notion of a summer venue.
One recent weekend, Greg Passan came up from New York City, a three-hour drive, to meet friends, have a picnic, and listen to some Beethoven.
It's relaxed, but it feels very, not formal, but ritualized in a way, right? People are coming with their chairs and their tables and their bottles of wine, and clearly it's something they do all the time and have very specific ways of doing it. And so it's the social aspect as well as the musical.
Some have been coming for decades, like Bob Rosenblatt. A World War II veteran, his first visit was in 1947. He's been a volunteer usher for 40 years.
Every concert's my first. Doesn't it sound Pollyannish? But it's true.
Tanglewood officially celebrated its 75th anniversary with a gala concert featuring Yo-Yo Ma, John Williams, and James Taylor, among others. There will be more gala evenings during the summer in the Berkshires. For VOA News, I'm Jeff London in Lenox, Massachusetts.
You know, if you ever get a chance to go to Tanglewood, you should do it. There is nothing like Beethoven in a barn. It's amazing. They play everything there. You should go. Hey, listen, everyone. Thanks for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jim Harmon, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
To predict the future success of a nation, all you need to do is look at how it treats its women, said President Barack Obama recently during a speech before the African Union. Nobody would put out a football team and then just play half the team. You'd lose, said President Obama. The same is true when it comes to getting everybody an education. You can't leave half the team off, our young women.
When girls cannot go to school and grow up not knowing how to read or write, that denies the world future women engineers, future women doctors, future women business owners, future women presidents. That sets us all back. That's a bad tradition, not providing our girls the same education as our sons.
That is why earlier this year, President Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama launched the Let Girls Learn initiative. Through this program, a number of United States government agencies and non-governmental organizations, including the Department of State, U.S. Agency for International Development, PEPFAR, the Peace Corps, and the Millennium Challenge Corporation, work together to address some of the many challenges preventing adolescent girls from attending and completing school and receiving high-quality education. So, for example, in northern Nigeria, children displaced by conflict, especially adolescent girls, can continue their education at the newly developed learning centers. In Zimbabwe, through the Girls Empowerment Movement, Let Girls Learn helps establish clubs in schools that encourage girls to be educated and empowered decision makers. And in Kenya, the Global Give Back Circle helps disadvantaged girls pursue their education from upper secondary to university and gain skills that help them secure jobs. Let girls learn so they grow up healthy and they grow up strong. That will be good for families, and they will raise smart, healthy children, and that will be good for every one of your nations, said President Obama. Let's lift up the next generation of women leaders who can help fight injustice and forge peace and start new businesses and create. We'll all be better off when women have equal futures.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after.